Ah, the first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
Mutant strains of coronavirus inflicting serious economic damage in Europe. Meanwhile, the Brazilian stock market crashed today and the real tumbles with it. And lastly, how are rising yields going to impact risk assets? For all of this and more, I'm joined by Real Vision Managing Editor Ed Harrison. Ed, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, Jack. Great to talk to you as always on Monday. That's our day here.
Absolutely. Let's make a habit out of it. So, Ed, today the U.S. yield curve continued to steepen. The 10-year and the 30-year rose apace. The 30-year is now about the 2.18 level, and the 10-year is about 1.36. What do you make of all this?
Yeah, so I think it's very interesting because I had technical analyst Katie Stockton on. If you recall, I believe that was a week ago on Thursday, so 10 days ago, 11 days ago, and she was talking about 114.25 as a resistance level that we had problems breaking above. And as you know, intraday, we had broken to 118, 119. But what she was saying is if you had two Friday closes, that is 2 week closes above that level, 114.25, and that was a technical indicator for her that we were moving to the top of a range between 1 and 150. We started the year at 90 basis points. We moved from a range from 50 to 100 into a range now from 1 to 1, 150. We'd only been in the bottom half of that range. But then after she gave that that signal, we did, in fact, close above 114.25. And immediately, the 10-year just went ballistic, the long end of the curve, both 10 and 30. We're probably 20 basis points above where we were when she made that call. And so the next stop, I believe, is 150. And so, you know, what we're seeing in the markets is reflective of people's angst about those yields going higher.
Absolutely, Ed. And just to give this, some numbers behind the narrative, it's not just been that the yield has suffered. This has caused damage in investment grade as well as high yield debt. So LQD, which is the investment grade ETF, lost $7.4 billion in outflows over the past few weeks. And JNK lost $1 billion flowed out of JNK. And meanwhile, TLT, which is the ETF for long duration treasury assets, 20 years and above, that now has a short interest that's above 15%, which is where it was in 2018, the highest it's been since 2018. So, Ed, could you just really quickly give me and the viewers at home a framework of how when yields rise on the long end of the curve, I'm talking 10s, 20s, 30s, how does that impact the risk asset landscape? I'm talking growth equities, I'm talking value equities, I'm talking investment grade, high yield, leveraged loans. Ed, I love how I gave you an impossible question and I told you, I said, quickly, give me in 15 seconds or less. But so take as much time as you like, but what are you thinking in terms of that?
Yeah, so basically it's the yield on long-term treasuries are the yields that people use to discount the future. That means that when you think of a risk-free rate, you're thinking about U.S. treasury bonds and you look at it across the curve. If you're looking for longer duration assets, then you're looking at the longer end of the curve, the 10-year, the 20, the 30, as you were talking about. So when those rates are going up, what it's telling you is that those discount rates are going up so that the future cash flows that you're going to get 10, 20, 30 years down the line are, relatively speaking, less valuable than they would have been otherwise. And given how low the yields were, 50 basis points, now moving up to 140 basis points, that's a huge differential in terms of that discount rate. So if you are, say, Nikola, which is making no money now, but supposedly is going to make, you know, gobs of money 10 or 20 years from now, that means that that money that they're making, that cash flow that they supposedly are going to have 10 to 20 years hence, is worth much less than it was when Treasury yields were at 50 basis points. And this is true no matter what kind of long-lived asset that you're looking at. It's also true that when you look at junk or you look at investment grade, that they're basing off of Treasuries as well, in the sense that there's a spread that you're paying for in terms of default risk for those companies. And even if that spread doesn't increase, if Treasury yields increase, then those bond yields have to increase as well, everything else being equal.
Okay, great. So it's very bad for growth, less so for value, but basically it's bad for risk assets across the spectrum. And so now, Ed, I want to take that framework that you just laid out, and I'm going to say compare it to the price action of the day. So today, NASDAQ was down 2%. Meanwhile, the Dow Jones was actually in the green. And there's actually a chart that I made that I was fascinated by, which is the relative change in the NASDAQ, the daily percentage change minus the daily percentage of the Dow Jones. And basically, this is over the past year, it's the top five in terms of the overperformance of the Dow Jones relative to the NASDAQ. So you had those tech-heavy, long-duration NASDAQ assets bleeding today. Meanwhile, your Dow Jones stocks, which is comprised of your industrials as well as your stocks that have a lower duration generally, was in the green. What do you make of that?
Well, first of all, let me just say that you're like the chart master, okay? Because people who don't know this, you're coming up with these charts on your own. That is a great chart, the one that you just talked about. So hats off to you for looking at that. And I think that it definitely portrays the action that we're talking about today really well, because what it shows you is that people are rotating into those plays where there's more cash flow up front versus those that have more long-lived cash flows. I talked about Nikola. You were talking about Tesla, tech stocks, growth stocks. All of those companies that are in the NASDAQ, those are going to get walloped if interest rates continue to rise more relative to energy, as an example, where you're just making tons of money today, and potentially you won't even make any money in the future if we have a green energy future. So that's the dichotomy that we're seeing.
Absolutely, Ed. I'm so glad you brought that up. So we mentioned the NASDAQ was down 2%. Within that, Tesla down 5.6%, Moderna down 6%, DocuSign and Peloton down 7%. So it's really those growthy names that are getting battered today. And then compare that to oil, which, as you mentioned, is on an absolute ride. It's now well above $61. And the XLE, which is an ETF for oil stocks, is up 4%. All of the stocks in XLE are up. Marathon Oil up 10% today. So this isn't a joke. These energy names are on fire. And likewise, in the United Kingdom, we see some travel and leisure stocks like IAG, EasyJet, Wizz Air, all up 5 to 7%. Carnival Cruises up 8.7%. So today was an ultimate day for value. Do you agree?
Yeah, definitely. And you had two trends that you were talking about there that I thought were interesting. You can actually call it three trends. The one is this rotation trade. The second is what we're seeing in energy and commodities more generally speaking. That is that right now, people are talking about reflation. They're also seeing what's happening in Texas, or what did happen in Texas, and that's having some supply shocks. And as a result, energy is going to do well. So those are two things that are happening based upon that data. Then the third thing that's happening, I thought that was interesting, is the differential in what's going on in the UK, or even the US for that matter, and what's happening in Europe. If you look at any charts in terms of vaccinations so far, I mean, the UK is way ahead relative to Europe. I think they have something like 28% of their population that's received some sort of vaccination versus 6% for the EU, which is ridiculously low by comparison. Boris Johnson, the prime minister, he came out with a statement today saying that we are going to open up completely by June. So that means normal life in June, which means all those companies that you're talking about in the UK, they're going to actually get a fill up economically almost, you know, 3 or 4 months from now. Whereas in Europe, we have no idea when those the equivalent companies are going to get a fill up.
Yeah, Ed, that chart which I saw today on credit write-downs comparing the vaccination rate of the United Kingdom to the EU, it is very stark, as you mentioned. What is behind that disparity where the UK is getting 26, 27% vaccinated and EU is the laggard with barely, you know, not even 6% vaccinated?
Yeah, a lot of that has to do with, you know, bureaucracy and red tape. But some of it also has to do with the fact that people are very concerned in the EU about the vaccines, their efficacy, the AstraZeneca vaccine in particular, which is one that was shown to not be as effective against mild forms of the coronavirus in South Africa, the South African variant. And the South African variant, the British variant of the coronavirus have become ones that are just going around very much in Europe. Spain, as an example, France, another place. And so the result is that people are concerned that they can still get the coronavirus given those results, and they're not really as excited to take the AstraZeneca vaccine. So, you know, there are a lot of bottlenecks in the process in Europe right now, and they've just done a horrible job all around. Bureaucratically, they've done a poor job in terms of telling their people about the efficacy. For instance, in Scotland, they found that it was something like 94% effective at keeping people out of the hospital. That is the AstraZeneca vaccine, even more effective than the Pfizer vaccine. So what that means is if people get vaccinated, they're not going to go to hospital, which is really what you care about more than the fact that they, they got a mild form of coronavirus.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know ya at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Ed, I want to dive into this because you're an expert on Europe and you follow the coronavirus and the related news very closely. So when it comes to coronavirus in Europe, you are a very informed person. So I want to ask you more about that. But let's actually take a break and let's go to Weston Nakamura. Today, Ed, I don't know if you know this, but the Brazilian stock market has tumbled. It has essentially crashed today based on some news regarding the oil company Petrobras. So let's go to Weston Nakamura to hear what's going on. Weston, welcome back to the Daily Briefing. How are you doing?
Pretty good, Jack. How are you?
I'm doing well. So Weston, last time you were on the Daily Briefing last Wednesday, you came on to talk about a potential whiplash that you saw in the S&P based on some of the plumbing that you were researching within the VIX futures markets. How is that playing out?
Yeah, this is basically, so you're getting, you know, a pretty, I guess, somewhat sharp pullback in NASDAQ, especially today. And it's very much VIX-led. So you have the all-time highs last week on the eve of the VIX expiry that I was talking about. And then that, you know, front month rolled off. And then you have now spot VIX trading more in line with the March VIX, which is now higher. And that's been pulling the market down. So, you know, just basically this, you know, the continuation of that. My only worry is that if there's too much, if there's a lot of inflow going into UVXY and these other VIX-related ETFs that are forced to buy VIX futures, when it comes time to roll, you know, I mean, they might be stuck in a position where they're going to be spreading the front month and the second month mixed contracts, you know, and therefore impacting the overall index. But yeah, we'll see how that plays out.
Right. And so now now that that expiry has arrived, about half of the cash balance or the value, the net asset value of UVXY is in that March contract. And then some else is sprinkled on the other contracts. I was just looking at the UVXY now. How do you think that that will evolve? What are you seeing in the VIX term structure? Basically, Weston, you came on last week, you made a good call. What are you seeing going forward?
I mean, I think that that second month, front month VIX spread really does matter to the direction of the index. The more that spread compresses, because it got unnaturally extremely wide, as you know, I showed on my chart, and when that kind of corrects back towards more normal levels, where they don't, the prices aren't so far deviated from one another, that compression is going to lead to a downward pull in the S&P cash index. So as long as that happens, you know, that's going forward, because you don't have a roll or anything coming up. We just had one. So, you know, that's, I see downside because of that. But
right. So all quiet on the Western front for now. Let's move into something that's a little bit more volatile, something that's about to get the blood pumping a little bit. Today, Weston, you messaged me quite early in the morning that Brazil, the Brazilian markets had opened up deeply in the red. The MSCI Brazil index down as much as 5%. Other indices down. The real down against the dollar about 2.5-3%. What do you make of that, Weston?
Yeah, that's pretty big. So basically, what happened was over the weekend, Bolsonaro had fired the CEO of Petrobras, which is the, you know, the state-run Brazil oil company, and this is a chief executive who is, you know, University of Chicago educated and all that. And he's very much so a free markets person. And Bolsonaro had a problem with, you know, his ratings have been plummeting because of mishandling COVID. You have truck drivers in Brazil who are, you know, striking, and he obviously wants his ratings up. And he was blaming a lot of that on oil prices heading ever higher and fuel prices. And he was basically telling the, you know, Petrobras to, like, you need to cut, you know, you need to lower oil prices. The CEO saying, you know, no, I'm not going to, this is not a dictatorship, right? And well, apparently it's a dictatorship because he's no longer there. And then come futures open today, you have the market sell off at what, 5%, 5.5% down for the Ibovespa index futures. Mm-hmm. You have 2.5% on the real is pretty big. It broke through a key level. Mind you, the real was already the worst performing currency last year. This is against the weakening dollar at that too. And against even like the lira, which is a horrendous situation with the currency crisis. So they were already, you know, it's already like capital flight happening. But now I think that the reason you're seeing such a significant sell-off, and the reason I don't think that this is going to be some sort of bounce back, is because Bolsonaro has lost the trust of foreign capital flows, foreign investment. You know, like when you capital leaves, when capitalism leaves, is what I said in my note, right? So if you go to the exchange, you can see my note on this. But basically, that's what it comes down to. It's, you can't repair that. If that is really the, you know, the damage that's being done to the investor psyche, you cannot repair that overnight. And, you know, so many people just came into Brazil, so many flows came into Brazil, you know, 2-3 years ago, because of Bolsonaro was supposed to be this very pro-business sort of agenda. And now if he's kind of, you know, pulling the strings and picking and choosing, you know, like some activist investor, right? Well, that's not good. And investors are not going to like that. And I think that also at a time when you have these, you know, I mean, I think it's arguably fair to say that equity valuations are rather lofty right now, but it's very tough for fund managers. Yeah, some could say. But it's tough to sell. If you're going to sell something down, you know, this is a perfect idiosyncratic sort of situation. If you want to sell down like a major global index, is Brazil. So I think that the real and the Bovespa index are going to probably take a pretty sustained beating. And EWZ, which is the iShares ETF, as well.
Mm-hmm. Just to give a little bit of context there, Weston, there's a lot to unpack. So first, as you mentioned, the Brazilian real has had a horrible 2020 against the dollar. And by the way, it's not in the DXY or the US dollar index. And that is why, you know, the dollar has been a fantastic currency relative to the Brazilian real, but you'd never know because it's not in the dollar index, which is always quoted. Secondly, I just like to say that in the EWZ, the Brazil ETF, the largest stock, that the stock that is down by most is by far Petrobras, which is the stock that's involved. Both the common and the preferred are down about 19.7, 19.8 just today. And those stocks command about 6% and 4.5% respectively within EWZ. But we're also seeing some bleeding that's not Petrobras, other companies.
Crude oil is up 3% today, you know, so that should tell you enough, even directly, right? So this is an oil company and it's down 20% on a day that crude is rallying.
Yeah, so absolutely. So Weston, how do you chart your thesis going forward? Is it a fundamental thesis that you think that these stocks will be, if not nationalized, then have the heavy hand of government risk?
I'm not saying there's no nationalism or anything like that going on. I think Bolsonaro explicitly tried to make that clear, that like this is not, you know, any sort of a top down like heavy handed thing. I just don't like the guy. he's just not helpful for Brazil. That sounds like a top down heavy handed thing, right? You're picking and choosing what you're to your own political agenda because you want to get your ratings higher, and investors are not going to stand for that. And so when you have an index that's already down year to date as it is, you know, I mean, if you look at EWZ's fund flows, even they've been kind of trickling in. There's not too much enthusiasm for fund flows when going into EWZ, but when they flow out like they really, you know, head for the hills, as was the case for the March sell-off last year, and then, you know, a few weeks following. So people are happy to pull money out of Brazil very quickly, it seems. And mm-hmm. You know, I don't play them. The thing is that, because with these currencies, and I have a video called on the exchange as well, about, you know, explaining the dollar. I think it's like what is the dollar? Something very, very straightforward like that. But basically what I'm saying is that, you know, currencies are interesting because they're currencies are pair trades, right? Like you can't just buy just the dollar. You can't bet on just the dollar, like the dollar strengthening, the dollar weakening. Dollar weakening versus what? Dollar strengthening versus what, right? So people just talk about the dollar like it's some sort of, you know, singular instrument that you could be traded. No, it's not. It's a currency. It's a pair trade. It's a dollar versus the yen, or so on and so forth. When it comes to the real, the Turkish lira, and the ruble, it isn't. You know, when those currencies move, when it's like USD BRL, USD TRY, or USD RUB, the USD part really has nothing to do with it. It really is 100% whatever Turkey is doing, aka whatever, you know, Erdogan's doing, or whatever Putin's doing, or whatever in this case Bolsonaro is doing. So when you see currencies, currency pairs move, especially in times of COVID, what makes it interesting is that currencies are the market's reflection of relative government competency. Sometimes is how I kind of look at it. So COVID is like this pop quiz that got sprung out onto society, onto every country. And it's like, you figure out how to deal with this with your given resources, with your given economies, with your given political systems. Everyone gets the same pop quiz. And the markets believe that apparently last year in 2020, Brazil had one of the worst managed, you know, COVID pop quiz results as expressed through USD BRL.
And Weston, lastly, how are you thinking about putting on this trade?
Well, I'm assuming that most people can't really trade, you know, the local index futures, but you can trade EWZ or you can short the real against the dollar. So yeah, I mean, it would just be, you could go long the USD BRL Or you can, I would say you could buy puts on EWZ, but implied volatility is kind of high. So I don't
think really that means it's a crowded trade. That means a lot of people want to do what you want to do.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it wasn't, you know, yeah, I guess it, I think that the index is basically just going to, you know, it fell a lot today and it's just going to, it's not going to have this rebound rally. But that doesn't really put in, you know, a 25 delta out of money put like in the money. So you're just going to, you know, you're just going to bleed away your implied volatility premium. So I would say that if you, you know, if you want to short an index, a global index, because you can't really do that anywhere else, this is the one to do it. You know, it's tough to do it on the S&P. It's obviously tough to do on, you know, Nikkei or whatever else. So, but this one, I think that foreigners are going to be gone, and I don't think that they're coming back anytime soon.
Very interesting trade. Weston, thank you, as always, for coming on the Daily Briefing and sure. Sharing your insights.
Sure. I encourage everyone to just go to my page on the exchange. It's just a short Brazil trade and is the title of my trade idea. And let's have a discussion about it. If you disagree, please come on the exchange, tell me where I'm wrong, and let's figure this out.
Thanks, Weston. All right. So, Ed, we're back with you. We were talking about Europe, and I want to read a quote from your blog, Credit Writedowns, today. So not only is the double dip for Europe already baked into the cake, now we also have to fear another wave because of the poor policy response. So we talked about the virus, but can you put that in the context of the fiscal and monetary and economic woes of Europe that you've been following over these last few months?
Yeah, so basically Europe, they went into lockdowns much more than the United States. When you look at the data are saying that Europe was in a double dip recession. They're still in that double dip recession now. The thing that people care about is this foot race between these variants, you know, the Brazilian variant, the South African, the UK variant, which are these mutated variants that are more virulent, and the vaccine. The quicker you roll out the vaccines, the more likely you are to not have any problems with those variants. Europe, obviously, they're not rolling out the vaccines very quickly, and they're already in lockdown. Those two, they're not a very good combination. And so as a result, the economic pain will be greater. Then when economic pain is greater, you put the money into deficit spending within the individual Eurozone states. As an example, Italy has a 160% government debt to GDP number, which is the same amount that Greece had when they defaulted all those years ago during the European sovereign debt crisis. As we speak, in fact, the EU is looking to take the Stability and Growth Pact, which says you have to have 3% deficits, 60% debt to GDP, or going down to that number. And they're going to say, okay, because of the pandemic, we're going to give you guys a pass. But once the pandemic's over, there's not going to be any more free ride. There are going to be no more passes. These countries are not monetarily sovereign. It's not like Mario Draghi, who's now the head of the government in Italy, can go to his tree and pick off some lira, or you know, ask the Bank of Italy to finance the deficits that he wants to create in order to keep things going in the Italian economy. He can't do that. And so what it means is you have a reckoning. You have a reckoning on the fiscal front. You have a reckoning on the growth front as a result of that, which means that Europe potentially could underperform for a longer period of time because of austerity, or you're going to get some sort of monetization. And that monetization is going to create political strife like you've never seen, at least not since the European sovereign debt crisis. So the pandemic is setting us up for big problems once it's over from a fiscal perspective in Europe.
Oh, that's interesting. Ed, you mentioned a lot of challenges that Europe is going to face. Is one of them the fact that yields are already so low, in many cases negative, so there's just not much more that the ECB can do? Or is that a roadblock, or is it not? Is that a commonly held mistaken view?
Well, you know, I mean, for Italy, it's great that the yields are low, because as long as the ECB has its back, then its yields can be low. They're not negative the way that they are in Germany, but they're mildly positive, which is good for the Italian state, because Italy, therefore, doesn't have as much debt service problem as it otherwise would have. But ultimately, it's the spread to German bunds which are going to be the big problem. Eventually, you know, the potential for default or redenomination risk is going to rise, and people are going to say, wait a minute, do we really want to be holding this Italian debt? Is the ECB going to have their back? And so then there's the potential that the ECB, you know, it's a critical juncture, in the same way that the Fed has to decide how far are we going to let yields rise. The equivalent is true for the ECB. How far are we going to let Italian yields rise? That will eventually be the question. And I think that we're going to see that play out once the pandemic is over.
Ed, I'm glad that you brought the Fed back into it, because let's go back to the U.S. And to you, Ed, I know one of your favorite phrases is when the rubber hits the road. I'm looking at the high yield to worst and relative to the investment grade yield to worst, and I'm barely seeing an uptick. It's so small, I have to go closer to my screen to see it. And it's, you know, where yields were 3 weeks ago, essentially. In October, yields were criminally low, and now they're much, much, much lower than they are now. So I'm not really seeing that pickup in high yield investment grade. The only really thing that I am seeing in it is in the 30-year mortgage rate, and that's because I think it is a 30-year, so it has a 30-year duration. So where do you think the rubber hits the road with investment grade and high yield?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, where does the rubber hit the road in terms of where do you cry uncle first because of rates going up? I mean, I think there are four markets that you could look at this point. One is obviously the equity markets, where, you know, we're very leveraged to growth in the United States. That's one of the reasons that the U.S. has outperformed. The S&P has been a much better place if you want to have growth. Second is high yield. Third is leveraged loans. And then fourth, I would say, are mortgages. All four of those are susceptible to yields going up. And of course, just like with Italy, you have the double whammy in the United States with junk and with corporates, because there's a spread, there's a spread because of default risk. So if yields go up, not only will the yields go up, but the spread will go up. Same thing for Italy. If yields in Europe go up, then not only will Italian yields go up, but the spread to bunds will go up. So they're doubly hit by that. So when the cycle turns down, all of those things can happen in the U.S. And so you have to ask yourself, which one are we more leveraged to at this particular point? Are we leveraged to the financial conditions that are loose because of growth stocks? Are we leveraged to the uptick in the economy because of housing, or are we discounting too much that we're at the beginning of a cycle and not near the end of a cycle from the credit perspective? Because to the degree that you see an uptick in yields, it might well be that you have a default cycle that causes liquidity problems in those markets, leveraged loans and high yield.
Ed, maybe next week we can do a deeper dive on high yield and leveraged loans, because I know you have a lot of experience in that space. It's a space that I'm very interested in. But as we close, before we let the audience get on with their lives, I want to show a clip that airs tomorrow. It's of an interview that airs tomorrow with John Hussman and Milton Berg about, are we in a bubble? So let's take a look at this clip, Ed, and then I want to see your reaction.
Okay.
Do you believe that the equity markets in the United States are in a bubble?
Yes.
And I would say I do not know. Question number two, do you believe that the Bitcoin asset is a bubble?
Yes.
I would say to that yes as well. Question number three, do you believe that the bond market, the US government bond market, has been in a bubble?
No, but only yes, no answers, or
at this point, yeah. And I believe yes. I think the answer to that question is yes.
So, Ed, what do you think?
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah, I don't know whether his husband is gonna get some stick from the pro crypto crowd here at Real Vision. I thought it was interesting. Milton Berg was talking about bonds or a bubble. Everyone's talking about bonds being a bubble, but let me just tell you, here's what I'm thinking: that if we get a crash up, we're gonna get a crash down. It's an exact replay of what we saw in 2018, except instead of the Fed engineering the crash up in yields by raising rates four times as they did in 2018, it's the market moving yields higher. At some point, they'll move it high enough that either it draws a reaction from the Fed or something breaks. And so I think that that crash up will mean a crash down in yields, which means that we're not in a bubble, that we still have a ways to go before we see yields actually rise on a consistent and permanent level in the United States.
Mm. Ed, and when you say before the Fed does something, are you talking about the yield curve control, where the Fed will pin rates on the yield curve and say, if it goes one basis point above this, we're bringing it right back down?
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of different things that the Fed can do that they've said that they're going to do. But the first thing that they need to do is tell us which of those things that they want to do are the likely response. But they will respond if financial conditions start to weaken. And I think, yes, yield curve control is one of the responses, one of the more likely responses that they'll engineer.
Great. Well, thanks, Ed. I hope, Ed, you get a chance to watch the interview with John Hussman and Milton Berg tomorrow. I hope the audience does as well.
I'm looking forward to it. You know, I think I've interviewed Milton Berg, and I haven't seen John Hussman on the platform, so I'm excited.
Yeah, well, he's a subscriber, so this is our first time getting him on the platform on this side of the chair. So yeah, it's Ed, it's been great. Thank you as always for sharing your insights and letting me pick your brain. Talk to you next week.
Yeah, let's do it again.
Great, thanks.